Cooney, reel 5.
If it's a story about signals and pigeons generally, tell me anyway, as it's in your mind.
Well, the story, I think it was Hunter Weston, who was a very well-known commander at that time, who was commanding a battle in this area, and he was most anxious for the news, the first news to come in, and he was haunting the pigeon loft. And presently in flapped a pigeon, and he was pounced on, and his message was taken out of his little case. And it read, "I'm fed up with carrying this bloody bird any longer." Now, the point of it was, if he'd only put the time and the place at which the message sent up, it would have been the most valuable message.
Because they would have known
where it got to.
Yes, exactly. Well, going back to this operational training at Erin, you've described for me the what the crew consisted of and what their various jobs were. Have we completed that, would you say?
I think so. I'll only say about this training at Erin, when we got our tanks, it was almost entirely a matter of driving, trying to get the feel of the machine and what it could do and how it could handle it, how it could be handled. That was that was all it was, really.
Mm.
And when we eventually went up to the line on the beginning of April, we went into the Vimy Ridge, which the Canadians took on the 9th of April.
Yes.
In a snowstorm. And in fact, the poor old tanks just couldn't make it.
What were the problems at Vimy Ridge for you?
The place was just blasted to bits. They had 10 days bombardment, and all the ground was aerated, and you couldn't get a grip on anything. It was just a sludgy mess. You just got along and along, and eventually you stuck.
Before we go on to Vimy Ridge, there's still a couple of questions I wanted to ask you about Erin. And
oh, yes.
When you were actually training with the driving of the vehicles for the first mm-hmm. time, what kind of problems did you encounter?
Oh, they were merely problems of control of the machine. The fact that you had one gear on each track, that you had a throttle on each track, there were all sorts of driving problems which were not common to motor cars or anything. They had to be done from scratch. And then you had a secondary gearsman, you see, which the driver had to signal to tell him which gear he wanted that track in.
Mm-hmm.
And it required a great deal of practice to make that all run smoothly and easily. That, I think, is the chief thing. And then, of course, you had the ordinary problem of just controlling the actual machine. When you went up over a little rise and you tipped over the front and went down the other side. And we used to go down very steep slopes. And quite exciting. But it wasn't easy. And as I say, eventually most of the tanks in the battle got bogged down. Mm. That's where they failed.
This problem of communicating each other with each other inside the tank, with all the noise and movement. You've said you used to tap
signals,
your Spanish.
Yes. Yes.
Could you tell me a bit more about these signals? What other ones did you use and what did they mean?
Well, they were the signals to gearsmen. They were the signals to the gunners. If you could try and point out targets to them, it was very difficult. It was all pointing and grimacing. As a rule, it meant that you, as an officer, you left your seat and went back and put the chap on his target himself. It was the only way it worked. And, of course, at that time, when you were in battle, the Boche had by then an armour-piercing bullet, which made it a bit uncomfortable, not very harmful, but they used to buzz around the insides like mosquitoes.
Were there any incidences involved with the operational training period at Erin which stick in your mind?
No.
Anything occur?
No, I've almost forgotten all about that aspect of our training.
Okay.
I can't think, except that it was just really driving.
Yeah. Now, as far as your experience was concerned, the first occasion in which you went into action with the tanks was, as you've already said, at the Battle of Vimy Ridge on April 1917. One thing which interests me about that battle, did you get much of a briefing in advance of it? of the part in the action which the tanks were supposed to play?
Very little. I can't remember any of the details, except you were given the objectives, you were given the starting line, you were given the time, and that really is about all you've got.
Mm-hmm.
You had to do your best on that.
Can you remember what your objective was?
No.
Mm.
It was only a line... A line drawn on a map.
Take me through this first action as a sort of story from beginning to end, as far as you can remember, of what happened to you and your tank in the Battle of Vimy Ridge.
Well, it was snowing and it was 4 o'clock in the morning and quite dark, and it was just about as lousy as it could be. And we led the infantry over our front line, and I shall never forget... Just getting light. We crossed the German front line, and in the German front line, with his camera all teed up, taking a picture of us, was one of our own photographers. That impressed me a lot. And I went to the Canadian official records later on when the war was over, and I got several of the photographs. I don't know what's happened to them now. I think they're in the museum here. Of the whole thing, most interesting. But I gave that man full marks. He was in the German line before the tanks, before the infantry, before anybody. He had to get his camera in the right place.
That's awfully interesting, because one hears that official photographers, both still and movie, and film cameramen, during the First World War, were very much discouraged from getting too near the front line because officers thought they just got in the way.
I think they may have been, but this chap was not going to be discouraged. He was there.
Okay.
And I en passant, I've had several occasions to do with cinema cameras and photographers and the like. I've always been very, very impressed with them. Their standards, quite astonishing.
Mm. Yes, I think they do tend to be craftsmen, don't they? Very concerned with the quality of their output. Carry on with your story anyway. You saw the...
Well, there they were, and we chugged on, and eventually the infantry caught us up. By this time, everything was getting a bit disjointed. The barrage had practically finished, and German replies had practically finished, and it was just a question of struggling onto the objective. And we bogged down, like pretty well every... Some of them got up to the top of the ridge. They all bogged down at the top where there were cockshies for the German gunners. But that was the end of it. It was, as far as we were concerned, I think, of no value at all. That's what I would say. The tanks, the conditions were hopeless. And that was the tendency, of course, of the higher command, was to use tanks in those sort of conditions. They did it at Ypres and Passchendaele and places like that. Hopeless conditions for using tanks. And even at Alamein, they put them in the most hopeless ways. It's been our trouble ever since there have been tanks. Mm. Nobody would ever use them as they were really meant to be used.
So the lack of success was not due to any enemy resistance, purely due to the battlefield conditions?
It was due to the conditions.
Mm.
And it wasn't till Cambrai, when the conditions were fitted to us, that we could do any good.
Yes. Did you at this, or any later operations in which you were involved with tanks, have an opportunity to see how the Germans reacted to them, how they tried to deal with them?
They were, in my opinion, superb. They were full of ingenuity. They started on the original Mark IV tanks, that was on the Somme, in 16. They had exhausts, and the exhausts were covered by an angle iron like that, one to each cylinder, you see, half a dozen. The old German would lie on the track as it went up, and he'd put egg bombs down the exhaust. To my mind, required courage of a very high order.
Indeed.
And so they had to put wire netting over them and stop them playing that particular trick. But generally speaking, the German would go on shooting at them even though he wasn't penetrating them.
Mm.
And he caused a lot of trouble inside the tank. Although it didn't come through, when a bullet hit the outside, the inside oxidized and came off in a little spark. And it was most unpleasant. Although it wasn't coming in.
And sparks would be whistling around inside.
Quite sufficient to put you off your stroke. I don't suppose the German ever realised he was putting us off our stroke. But it was, very definitely, it was most off-putting.
Did they develop any other anti-tank measures?
No. They eventually produced a rifle, an anti-tank rifle, I've forgotten when, which was about 0.5 or something like that, a good big thing, which would penetrate you, but then it was a matter of luck what it did when it got in.
I've just remembered that question that I was going to ask you and I had forgotten. What was it like to actually ride in these things? What were the physical comforts like, or lack of?
Oh, there weren't any comforts, but there was a certain satisfaction in being surrounded with armour that you hadn't got when you were on your feet outside. And that operated until one suddenly became aware that all the petrol, which is high octane, was in a big tanks on each side of you, and if anything hit that, that was the end of you. But generally speaking, the driver and the officer had a comfortable seat to sit on. The gunners had little bicycle seats on which they sat, the ordinary bicycle seat. And the secondary gearsman really sat on the cold steel, as far as I remember. And I suppose it was not uncomfortable. Mm.
Let's take up the story of Vimy Ridge. You had got bogged down in mud, you were explaining to me. And there you were.
Never stayed.
And what happened to you?
Till the day somebody came along after the battle and pulled the old machine out.
This must have been quite a problem of retrieving tanks.
Oh, yes, it was. It was the workshop problem, a very considerable one. Yes. One probably well worth, if you can, getting your special line on.
That was a bit. So May the 3rd, 17, your next operation was at Bulikor. What was your task here?
The task was the same, and the conditions were absolutely different, because it was very hot. And except for the fact that that was the Hindenburg line, which had been specially enlarged to stop tanks, it would have been quite a good show. But of course, we lost contact with our infantry.
Yes.
That was the trouble.
The job you haven't mentioned
yet. We were going to our objective, which was again a line on the map, the other side of the Boche line, with the idea of putting the infantry onto their successive objectives. And we lost touch with our infantry. And we struggled on, and then eventually we ran into some difficult bits of work, and eventually I had to get out and try and get the machine across a very difficult trench. There were no Boche there, and there were no infantry there, no Irish there. But we just went on until we got hit by a shell, actually. I think pure chance hit. Laid me out and one or two others. I'd been outside the tank for a good hour then, that time, and we had a bit of. We got hold of the infantry. A fellow called Tom Westwood and I got hold of the infantry, and they'd lost themselves. They didn't know where they were going or what they were doing. We put them, as we thought, on the rails again, as best we could. But again, it was a very unsatisfactory operation.
How was it that you had lost contact with the infantry?
Well, the infantry didn't go where they were supposed to go at the time they were supposed to go. And you couldn't see anything. There was a colossal lot of artillery fire going on. And sand, it was dry, sandy, being thrown into the air all the way. You didn't know where you were. Very hard to find, unless you could go with the sun, which we did very largely.
I think last time when we discussed this incident, you told me that the infantry actually ran away, and you had to adopt some radical steps to control them.
Yes, I did, but I don't. I'm not sure that's a good thing to say.
Well, it happened.
Yes, it did happen. Yes, that's quite right. When we were out, we found them going back in large droves, and this fellow Tom Westbrook and I. Tom Westbrook, he was a much older man than me. He said, "Come on, we've got to stop them." And he said, "Get your gun out, and anybody who doesn't go forward, shoot him." And he did. He shot one or two of them. He got control of them. I didn't. I was didn't like to.
Yes. It must have been approaching something resembling a rout.
It was the old story of two or three chaps to a bunk, and everybody sees them and they all go. And the more go, the more join in. Fortunately, he stopped it in time. He got them back. What happened, I don't know, but I was wounded shortly afterwards.
Fuller's Psychology of the Crowd would have something to say about that.
Very much so, yes. That's the sort of thing that happened.
Yes. Did you, as a result of this very different kind of operation at Bullycore, as compared with the Vimy Ridge operation, learn anything more about both the strengths and the weaknesses of the tank?
No, not really. Me personally, no. I thought that really I was quite convinced that using tanks in either of those ways was just not on. This wasn't the idea at all. We were all quite sure of that. We could have got miles if the ground was good and hadn't been ploughed up, and if there was surprise and no artillery bombardment, all that sort of thing, we could have done well.
But the ground was good at Bullycore, wasn't it?
Well, it was dry, but it had been bombed